Thanks for joining us. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is visiting WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Children don't have strokes. Just ask Jared. That was the title of a story in the New York Times by my guest Jonathan Dienst. It was the story of his 7-year-old son, a happy, athletic second grader who had a stroke while playing on a summer afternoon. Jonathan Dienst is a reporter with WNBC-TV in New York. He joins me in the studio, along with his wife, Victoria Dienst. And also here in the studio is Dr. Rebecca Eichord. She's director of the Pediatric Stroke Program at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And joining us down the line from the Argo Network in New York is Dr. David Salzberg of the Rusk Institute at New York University. Thank you all so much for coming in and joining the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
And Dr. Salzberg, we have you on the line from New York as well.
Yes, you do. Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. Let's start with Jared's story. Vicky.
Sure. Monday, June 23rd, I picked up Jared from school. It was a beautiful Monday afternoon. We walked over to the playground. He joined up with his buddies and started playing baseball. And at about a half hour later, all of a sudden, he was sitting down in the middle of the playground. I walked over and told him, you know, you can't sit in the middle of the playground. It's not a good situation. He said, I don't feel good. They said, come, let's go sit over on the bench. He came over to the bench. He sat down. His eyes started to roll back a little bit. He became a little bit pale, and I immediately thought he was dehydrated. So a friend gave me some water to give him. He drank some water. He said, I really don't feel good. I really don't feel good. I said, quickly, let's go home. He got up from the bench, and he started to zigzag across the playground, which at that point, I immediately picked him up, turned to a friend to take my other two children, and I ran a few blocks down to New York Cornell's emergency room, just yelling at him to stay awake, stay awake. I was afraid he was going to pass out.
So. And as far as you know, in the minutes before this happened, he hadn't bumped his head or fallen or anything. It came out of the blue, as far as you know.
It did come out of the blue. A few days before that Thursday night, he had a bad headache, but nothing that was significant enough for me to keep him home from school. He woke up the next morning feeling fine. It went away with some Tylenol. And a couple weeks before that, he had a collision in a Little League baseball game with a boy. But he immediately got up from the ground, and it wasn't something that would be remarkable in thinking that this was about to happen to him.
So, Vicky, you ran to the hospital. You got there after carrying Jared there. What happened when you got there?
We checked in. They immediately took his vital signs, which he was normal. And then they admitted him into the emergency room. They had a few different triage doctors come over to check his signs, tried to have his finger point to his nose, which he couldn't do. They asked him to walk, which he couldn't do on his own. And he was slurring his words. His left side of his face was sort of drooped down. And they just kept looking at him and trying to figure out what was going on and started ordering various tests for him.
You called Jonathan and said that something serious was happening. Jonathan, you arrived at the hospital, but it was several hours after you arrived that doctors started talking about even the possibility of a stroke.
Right. It never came up in the first couple of hours, the poisoning, seizure, other possible factors that could cause such symptoms in a child. But what stood out to me when I got there was, one, how awkward my son was when he tried to walk or do any sort of motor skills. He was very limited in his abilities. His speech was terribly slurred, and the droopy face. And you know, as I wrote in the New York Times article, if a 70-year-old had walked in, perhaps the classic signs of stroke would have immediately been picked up upon by the medical professionals, by us as parents. But this patient was 7. So who knew at that time? And as Dr. Eichord later would explain, and the neurologist, Dr. Packard at New York Cornell, you know, this needs to be on the radar screen because it does happen in children.
So when did they eventually start looking at the possibility of a stroke?
Basically, after, you know, they did a CT scan, came back normal. The blood work came back normal. And we continued to say there was something very wrong with our child. And so we finally put a call into the neurology department ourselves and with the emergency room staff saying, we need this to be looked at. And so they sent him for an MRI. And so I guess about 5 hours into it, 6 hours in.
And once they realized what they had?
Then it was about 8 hours after the MRI results came back, and then the stroke team responded, because the faster you get help into a stroke victim and open up vessels and prevent another stroke from happening, the better the outcome. So the sooner you get help in a stroke patient, whether it's a child or an adult, the better.
Both of you, what was your reactions when you heard that it was a stroke, that Jared had had a stroke?
It was horrible. I mean, you do everything that you can to sort of protect your child with and keep them healthy. And this was just something that all of a sudden was so out of our hands and now left into the hands of an amazing, you know, medical team. And we just couldn't grasp really what it meant. I understood there was a brain injury. And, you know, they couldn't tell us, which as a parent, what you want to know right away is he going to be okay? Is he going to be back to his normal self, you know, that he was 8 hours before? And they thought he was going to do well. They just didn't know. They couldn't tell us at that point, really, you know.
I couldn't understand. I had never heard of a child having a stroke before. This was totally new to me. And many of my colleagues and friends and family and even other doctors had never heard of this. And yet, as you said earlier, it's the sixth leading cause of death in children. And my wife right away picked up on the seriousness of it. Will he walk again? Will he have another stroke? Will he be able to remember and speak? And she was firing these questions, you know, right off, you know, in the first minutes of this diagnosis, as I was just trying to get my mind around, what do you mean my child had a stroke? I don't understand.
Dr. Eichord, director of the Pediatric Stroke Program at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, does the fact that this is a relatively rare condition account for the failure to diagnose Jared's case immediately, or is something else happening?
Yes, that's very much related to it. And also the fact that the ability to give an acute stroke treatment is really relatively a new concept. And many neurologists who trained, say, at the same time I trained, really didn't train in the era when acute stroke care for adults was even on the horizon. So even if one were to think about it, many practitioners, even in our current era, are really not geared and haven't been trained to react to a stroke in a rapid pace.
Give us some scale of this as a medical issue. I mean, I was confused by reading some of the numbers, because it seems that it happens actually very relatively infrequently, but as Jonathan pointed out, is the sixth largest cause of death in children.
Yes.
How do those numbers match?
So it affects children and infants at a rate that's, well, for children anyway, it's at a rate comparable to brain tumors. So if you wanted to kind of put it in the context of something else that is a serious neurologic disease, one doesn't necessarily think of brain tumors as vanishingly rare. So if one wanted to put it in context, you could say it's about as common as brain tumors in children. The numbers are a little bit actually hard to come by. And in order to get really solid, accurate numbers, one would need to do a population-based study, which means you survey an entire population.
Why are they hard to come by?
Because it requires knowledge of an entire population, and that kind of data is just not available. The closest we can come to that is from the Northern California statistics, where the existence of the Kaiser medical system allows the ability to capture data from a fairly large and well-defined population. And that kind of data, along with data from the Canadians, who are better at capturing more complete population-based data, has suggested that the rate of stroke in children, not neonates, but in children, is on the order of somewhere maybe as low as 3 per 100,000 or even as high as 12 per 100,000 children per year. In neonates, it's about five times that. And so for what's relevant to Jared and children like Jared is the child number.
Dr. David Salzberg joining us from New York. We went through the timeline of Jared's day, the day he had his stroke, in part because it's an extraordinary story, but also because there was such a big time lapse between him getting treated for the stroke and having the stroke. Is time of the essence in children with strokes as it is with adults who have strokes? Is it a similar procedure?
Well, I'll defer to Dr. Eichord in terms of the medical interventions that are done immediately following the acute diagnosis. From my perspective as a neuropsychologist who steps in afterwards to help a child, to help assess a child and his or her ability to renew their entrance back into the community, back into school, and how their recovery is, those early steps of diagnosis aren't as crucial. Clearly, defining the diagnosis and coming to terms with what the neurological and immediate medical needs are very crucial in terms of us as the next team to take on the child and reintegrate them. It helps us in terms of prognosis, in terms of making recommendations, in terms of knowing how to monitor them.
And Dr. Salzberg, you did monitor Jared through the first year of his school after the stroke, if I'm right.
Yeah, we met them. First, he came to the head physiatrist, Dr. Joan Gold at Rusk Institute, who looked at him from a general rehab perspective. We came in more towards the early spring of that year after a lot of medical interventions and series of studies have been done in terms of now assessing, well, he's a few months after the stroke, what are his deficits, what are his strengths and weaknesses, and how do we translate that into a child who's in our room and looks absolutely great? And that's really the crucial part of this diagnosis and any real head injury in a child. It's an invisible injury,
right,
and one that we don't necessarily see and we have to figure out.
Okay, Dr. Salzberg, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be coming back to you for more after this short break. The number here is 1-800-433-8850. You can also send us an email at drshow@wmu.org with your questions and comments. We'd love to hear you from you for our conversation on childhood strokes. I'm Cathy Kay. Do stay listening. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. You've joined our conversation on children having strokes. I'm joined in the studio by Jonathan and Vicky Dienst, whose son Jared survived a stroke. I'm also joined by Dr. Rebecca Eichord. She's from Children's Hospital at Philadelphia. Dr. David Salzberg, supervisor of pediatric psychology and neuropsychology at the Rusk Institute, is also joining us on the line from New York. I want to talk, Dr. Eichord, a little bit more about the treatment. We were talking about this in the break as well, this idea that Jared's case was not diagnosed for 8 hours. Is that something that would concern you as much in children as it did, as it would in an adult? We spoke about this a little bit before the break with Dr. Salzberg as well.
Well, the basic principle that happens in stroke is what we call time is brain, and that pertains to the young brain as well as the adult brain. And in the ideal situation, one would like to be able to institute therapies that accomplish sort of three key things. One is to reopen a blocked vessel. Two is to help the brain's own adaptive system to bring extra blood supply through unblocked blood vessels. And the third is to help the injured brain to prevent it from getting additional injury. And in the adult population, one has clot busters. In children, that's almost never feasible because one needs a very specific diagnosis. And what happened with Jared is quite common. So first of all, thinking about a stroke takes more time. Second of all, getting a specific X-ray that gives you the specific diagnosis usually requires what we call a brain MRI. A head CT scan is not sensitive in the early hours.
And one which has is why to, the CT exactly. scan with Jared came back
it was
normal.
Too early. And so one has to actually sedate a child in order to get a good quality study. And so by the time all of those things get lined up, the average time that a patient, a child, gets diagnosed is 24 hours. So in the ideal world, one would want to have an instant diagnosis. But compared to the average, 8 hours is ahead of the average. We hope that as we learn more and we get better systems of care and quicker diagnoses, we can move the bar.
You mentioned the clot busters there. In the initial stages of treatment, what else differs between children and adults?
Well, children have different causes of stroke. And so in adults, one thinks about the things that cause stroke when you're treating a stroke. For example, high blood pressure, atherosclerosis, meaning hardening of the arteries, diabetes. These factors really don't come into play in children. So our main target in children is to understand the cause of the stroke and to get therapy in place to help the brain's own adaptive systems to prevent new stroke from occurring and to prevent further progression of the stroke that has already occurred.
Vicky, I think I saw you quoted as saying that despite all of the best efforts of all of the doctors involved, you've never had an answer as to why Jared had a stroke.
Right. We don't have a hard answer. The doctors, I think, as a group, believe that what happened to Jared was a trauma to his neck, one of the arteries in the back of the neck. And it is caused by either, many times, I think, a sports injury or other extra factors that, you know, come into play, Dr. Eckert.
You mentioned that a couple of weeks before the stroke, he'd had this accident playing baseball. Is that right?
He did. He was playing Little League baseball. He was 7 years old. It was, just a fun game, completely supervised. And he was going to get a boy out on third base, and they collided. And it looked, scary, but it wasn't terrible, and they did collide. They rolled a little bit, but Jared got right up, shook it off, and continued playing. And there was nothing after that that he said, my neck hurts, my head hurts, my leg hurts, nothing that would indicate that there's something to come in the next couple weeks.
Dr. Eichold, would you think that could have caused it?
That's an educated guess. And trauma, even minor trauma, if it's of the right exact mechanism involving a fast twist or a hard motion of the head forward or backward like a whiplash, that can cause a little stretch on one of the arteries in the back of the neck. And that stretch by itself may not cause any problem, but what that stretch does is it can be a focus or a site where a clot can form, and that clot can form at any time in the days or weeks following. And if a clot forms there and then travels to a critical branch of the arteries in the brain, then it causes a stroke.
Jonathan.
I would just say we went through every test imaginable. We ran to New York Cornell, a fantastic institution that ran all of the appropriate tests, and they couldn't have come up with a reason. Dr. Eichord at Children's Hospital ran additional tests, and they could not come up with the cause. And I think that was the most difficult part for us as parents, was trying to accept, here was our child. He nearly lost his ability for a short time. He did lose his ability to walk and to speak and to understand. And what was going to keep this from happening again if we don't know why it happened in the first place? So we really went all over trying to get an answer. And the studies show not having an answer is the best medical result, because the risk of recurrence is lowest in children who don't have an explainable cause. A vascular disease, a hole in the heart, other causes of stroke in children are much more serious and could result in a recurrent stroke in a child, which, terrified us for the year that we were running around seeking answers. But it was tough to sort of come to peace as a family with not having a cause, but yet accepting that that's the best outcome.
We always want answers. It's extraordinary. When a medical situation arises, I'm sure you see this, Dr. Eichold, all the time, the patient always wants to have some sort of an explicable reason. Dr. Salzberg, of course, the fact that there wasn't a reason also meant that while you were treating Jared and following his case during that first year when he went back to school, not only did you have to treat him, but presumably you also had to institute things that meant that he wasn't likely to have a stroke again. You had to be very careful about his physical surroundings, didn't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think all the physicians that were working on his team, as well as his parents, very understandably, were being very cautious about what activities he could resume. And he made a tremendous recovery. I mean, you know, with all the medical interventions and, you know, he really did remarkably well. But everyone was being overly cautious and limiting contact sports and his reintegration into sports. And when you say that, it makes perfect sense and it's completely illogical. It's completely logical to do that. However, here's a 7 or 8 year old boy who's getting his whole life turned upside down because the things that he enjoyed the most, he's not doing. So it absolutely had implications for his psychological and emotional reintegration back into the community and how he felt about himself.
Aside from the things that he wasn't allowed to do, what were you specifically working on, and what was he able to do physically and what was he not able to do physically when you first saw him?
Sure. Well, you know, we looked at him from a number of perspectives. One is just he's had a lot of workups in terms of psychological, neuropsychological, neurological, physical workups. He had some weakness still on his left side. He still had some difficulties in terms of how quickly he was able to think through things, how efficiently he was able to express himself. So we were looking at him in terms of his learning abilities. He's a very, very bright child, and that stayed the same and always will. But he wasn't as quick to jump into the learning process as he transitioned into third grade. He was having difficulties with more complex reasoning, more complex expression, how he got his points across. So we were trying to assess and also make recommendations for the teachers, allowing him to take breaks, allowing the teachers to give him opportunities for resting. I mean, his brain was recovering. It's very, I mentioned before the break that this is an invisible injury. If you see a child who comes back to school with a cast on their leg, it's everyone understands he can't be running around and doing stairs. When you look as good as Jared does and always has, you don't see the injury inside of his brain to know that he needs breaks. He needs things broken down for him. He needs some accommodations, even though generally he looks good. So that's really where we stepped in from a school perspective, making recommendations, as well as with Jared and his understanding and acceptance and awareness that, yes, some things are different as he's recovering, and he has made a tremendous recovery, that some things he will need to ask questions about or take a break or ask to do it again or ask for clarification, and also emotionally help him, psychologically help him with some of the changes both in how he was functioning as well as some of the limitations that were being put on him.
Jonathan.
And just 2 points on that, on this recovery discussion. It was twofold. One was the physical. He had to go into rehab and work with therapists, occupational, physical, to get his motor skills back, to get that left hand working again, to be able to walk, to stand on one leg, to be able to walk backwards again. So that was the physical. And then when Dr. Salzberg and his team came in, you know, we worked with the Cornell therapist who did a fabulous job physically, and then Dr. Salzberg and his team about helping us academically and emotionally for this child who suffered the stroke. What resources does he need moving forward in school? How will he adapt, you know, given the frustration as a child being literally, you know, on the sidelines, on the disabled list for a considerable amount of time as his mind and body continues to recover?
Dr. Eichhorn, I've got several emails here from people who know somebody, a child that's had a stroke, and a few phone calls as well. One of them talks about a daughter. All the others are talking about boys.
Oh, yes.
Is this a random sample?
It's probably representative to some degree, study after study in childhood stroke, whether it's in newborns or older children, whether the cause is a hemorrhage or whether it's due to a blockage of a blood vessel. There is always a greater ratio of boys than girls, on the order of about 60% boys to 40% girls in all stroke subtypes. And we don't know the exact answer why. There are many thoughts about that. The thought that perhaps boys being more active may be more prone to these subtle minor head injuries, that only explains a small part of it. And so many of us who are doing research in this area trying to understand better what might be causing that ratio.
Let's go to the phones now to Katie in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Katie, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show.
Hello.
Hi, thank you for joining the program.
Thank you. It's incredible to me that this is your topic today, because my 7-month-old son was just diagnosed with a stroke about 2 weeks ago. He had some seizure activity, and an MRI showed that he had had a stroke. It appeared that this was a fairly old stroke. Of course, they couldn't tell us how long ago it happened. My question is, what kind of workup do you usually recommend as far as underlying causes and things we can do to make sure that there's not something correctable that would put him at risk for this happening again?
Okay, Katie, I'm going to put your question straight to Dr. Eichord.
Well, I'm so sorry to hear about your child's situation. The fact that you had some seizures in the beginning is a little bit of a clue that perhaps something happened early in life, and if the pictures right now are showing an older stroke, most likely this happened perhaps even as early as around the time of birth. And that brings up a point that's a very key point in childhood stroke, and that is about a third, 25% to a third of all strokes of all types affect newborns. And some of those who have a stroke as a newborn don't show their signs or symptoms until they're halfway through their first year. Usually they, at that point, then show that they have a weakness on one side of the body, or they may develop seizures.
So they've had a stroke a whole 6 months before you can actually see the symptoms
yes.
of the stroke.
Yes, and newborns, because their brains are not as mature and developed as someone who's older, the symptoms may not be visible at all. And they may not be visible until 3 to 6 months later. So the evaluation that's recommended for a newborn with stroke is slightly different than with older kids, because the workup for a child who had a stroke as a newborn is a bit different. And the main reason for that is that the risk of recurrence or having a second stroke is practically nil in children who've had a stroke around the time of birth, whereas that it's a bigger, more worrisome consideration. Still, one would like to know if there are conditions that might affect the child's health later on. So one would want to know if there's something going on with the heart. One would want to know if there's something abnormal with the blood vessels themselves. And often it's helpful to look for diseases that cause clotting problems. So those three areas are the typical broad areas that one would think about looking at as for causes of stroke.
Katie, is that helpful?
It's very helpful. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for joining the Diane Rehm Show. And Dr. Eichord, thank you for doing an on-the-spot diagnosis there for the program. We have an email here from Anne, who joins us to say, I'm a nurse vascular technologist who has worked with a stroke prevention trial for a decade focusing on children with sickle cell anemia who have a higher risk of stroke. We have been very successful in preventing stroke when we can identify the children at risk by using ultrasound evaluations of blood flow in the brain. This study should be considered standard care in the sickle cell population of children. Dr. Eichord.
Yes, that's exactly right. And stroke in children with sickle cell disease has really set the standard for how we might think about identifying causes and identifying treatments for children with stroke. And it's well known that children with sickle cell disease have about 100-fold increased risk over the general population of having a stroke. And due to very hard work going back at least 2 decades, the use of this special ultrasound technology in identifying children with sickle cell disease who are at the highest risk of stroke has been key in putting in place transfusion treatment to prevent them from having stroke. So it's a tremendous advance in the care of children with sickle cell disease.
Vicky, let's talk about Jared again, because it's been over a year now. It's been, 18 months almost?
Right.
Since he had his stroke. What stage is he at physically, academically, medically? Are there treatments that he's still taking, for example?
He was on aspirin for a year. He came off of that at his one-year checkup. So since then, he hasn't been having to take any regular medication. Physically, he looks great. He still has some inability with his catching a ball with his left hand, some sort of connection between the hand and the brain, sort of grasping that ball as quick as he used to be able to do it prior to the stroke, which bothers him a little bit. And then emotionally, he really would love to be out there playing most sports that most boys get to play, like football and hockey and those sort of things, and he's not able to. have that sort of contact. Academically, he's doing well. He definitely has a lot of support in school from various areas, including speech and OT and a special ed that has been extremely helpful with him.
And Jonathan, what did the doctor say about his prognosis?
Dr. Eichhorn explained to us and the doctors at Cornell, the one-year mark was really critical in a case like Jared's, that the risk of recurrent stroke is very high in the first weeks, if not months. And then over
time... That's when you had to really watch him very carefully for no contact sports and no possibility of a further head injury.
And just really watch him very carefully and keep him on the aspirin and to make sure there's no incident, another clot forming. And then after the year mark, they say in unexplained cases like Jared, the chance of recurrence goes way down based on the limited studies that are out there. And I think Dr. Eichhorn could perhaps explain that aspect a little better than I could.
Jonathan Dienst, whose son Jared had a stroke and survived at the age of 7, here in the studio with me with Vicky and with Dr. Eichhorn as well. Do stay with us for more on our conversation of pediatric strokes. The phone number is 1-800-433-8850. Do send us an email too to drshow@wmu.org. We're going to take a quick break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, shedding light on the shadowy connections between the pharmaceutical industry and the government during recent efforts to enact health care reform. We'll talk with Paul Blumenthal. Also, chances are you've never heard of William Stuart Halsted, but if you've ever had surgery, you could say he's affected your life. Dr. Gerald Imber explains. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Katty Kay of the BBC. You've joined our conversation on strokes in children. We are going to go straight to the phones again to Mark in Indianapolis, Indiana. Mark, thank you so much for joining The Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Your time. My question is about my daughter, Hannah, in the second grade, which was over a year ago now. Her teacher started to observe and report to us that she would notice Hannah going into what she referred to as just kind of some trances, kind of staring into the air. And she, in some conferences, she just asked if Hannah had had any trouble with seizures in the past, et cetera. And we really didn't make too much of it then. But then we began to notice some just kind of subtle changes in Hannah, in her moods, lots of emotion over small things, difficulty focusing, and then just kind of a scatterbrained kind of sense about her. And it's been quite some time now. We really never approached it or got aggressive with it at all. But listening to the conversation today, I wonder, is there such things as mini strokes in children, or TIAs? I guess I've come to know them from some older relatives. And could this possibly account for some of this behavior?
Dr. Eichhorn.
Well, children who have stroke sometimes have a TIA, which is the same as saying a transient ischemic attack prior to having their stroke. But the symptoms of a TIA are quite distinct from what you describe. And what you describe is that she seems just to have a temporary change in her awareness, where a TIA consists of a loss of neurologic function that usually is more visible, such as loss of speech and loss of strength or movement on one side of the body. So while it's certainly important to think of all types of causes of neurologic loss of neurologic function, the picture of a TIA is usually quite distinct from what you describe. So I would put that option pretty low down on the list for your child.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much.
Great, Mark. I hope that that helped. And we have also, on this issue of TIAs, we've got an email in as well from a woman whose daughter, who's 15, had experienced what her neurologist called a non-epileptic seizure, and her symptoms were twitching of her left leg, inability to grip things in her left hand, and loss of speech. The first one lasted hours. She couldn't walk or hold herself up. Now, after having five of these, they've lessened. My concern was always her loss of speech. Does this sound like a TIA or another form of stroke?
Well, again, you've brought up one of the real dilemmas that we have in diagnosing children who have stroke, and that is that other neurologic conditions can sometimes mimic a stroke. And children are more prone to have a seizure, which is the type of jerking movement that you explain as the part of the symptoms that happen at the start of a stroke. So when the seizures involve one side of the body and when there is a loss of function on one side of the body at the same time, then stroke does come into the picture as a consideration. And it just needs to be thoroughly evaluated whether it's primarily a seizure disorder or whether it's something else like a stroke that could cause the same types of symptoms.
Okay, we've been speaking to Vicky and Jonathan Dienst about their son, Jared, who had a stroke about a year and a half ago. And we're very lucky, Jared has said that he will join us in the studio. Jared, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming in to share your story with us. Tell me, how are you doing these days? You look pretty good.
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm about 80%, but getting there.
80%. What is there, do you think, that you can't do that you think your friends are doing?
Playing football.
Hmm. Annoying.
Yeah.
Do you like playing football?
Mm-hmm.
And why can't you play football?
Because if I get hit and then I might not be able to ever play football again. So that's why if I still have to be careful and not have another stroke.
So probably no wrestling.
Right.
That's annoying too, right?
Yeah.
And how about fighting with your brothers and sisters who are also here too?
No, not really.
Not really
no.
Fighting with brothers and sisters?
Yeah.
I guess that makes for a more peaceful household for mum and dad, right?
Mm-mm.
You find other ways to get at them?
Yep.
Good, I'm glad.
No, I usually get my sister, not my brother.
You get... And such is the way with all brothers. I've got boys and girls, and I know that it's always the boys that are getting at the girls.
Yeah.
Jared, what do you remember about having the stroke and about that time you spent in hospital?
Well, I couldn't walk, I couldn't use my left hand, and I couldn't hold myself up. I had to lay in bed and just do nothing there.
Were you scared?
A little bit.
But your mom and dad were with you?
Yeah.
Do you remember things like going into that big tunnel, the big white tunnel, and having the scans and the MRIs?
It's a CAT scan, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Was that a bit scary? Because you were in there by yourself, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but it wasn't scary because there was all these noises.
Right.
Yeah.
And what happened afterwards? You came out of hospital and then you started having to see doctors a lot, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't like it because sometimes I had to, like, go on the weekends and skip some of my playtime. Like, I couldn't really have fun with my brother.
Because you had to be going to the doctor.
Right.
Why couldn't the doctor see you on school days? Like, in the middle of a maths lesson, and then you wouldn't have had to do the maths lesson.
Because,
wouldn't that have been better?
Yeah.
Much better. Yeah, because then you could have got out a great excuse for getting out of the maths lesson. So you had to go and go to school because you had to catch up on your learning.
Right.
And then you had to go and see doctors at weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think that all of those doctors that you saw, do you think they helped you?
Uh-huh. Like, Aida, I think Aida was the only physical therapist I saw.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I saw any occupational therapist.
But you also saw Dr. Salzberg, David.
Yeah.
And what's he been helping you with?
My memory.
Right.
And my left hand and remembering things.
Do you want to say hi to him?
Hi.
Dr. Salzberg?
Hey, Jared.
Hi. Hi, Jared.
Hi.
Do you have any questions for Jared, Dr. Salzberg?
Well, I saw him a few weeks ago, so we did a podcast for New York Times. So my one question is which Star Wars Lego he picked out, but that's not important for the radio show. I obviously just want to know how he's doing.
How are you doing?
So, Jared, good. How are you doing?
Good.
Good.
What kind of exercises did you used to have to do with Dr. Salzberg, Jared? Do you remember them all?
No. I only remember, like, playing games, talking with him, and doing writing.
Right.
I think that's all we did, I think. And some memory things that helped me a lot.
Dr. Salzberg, was the memory a big issue in Jared's case? Was there a significant memory loss?
Well, typical with most of these children in cases, it's not necessarily so much a memory loss as we think about it in an older population. It's more the learning process, how you attend, how you consolidate information, how efficiently you retrieve information, how you monitor your attention and what you should be paying attention to. And all of that is necessary in order for the information to get in the first place, let alone to retrieve it. So he worked with myself and one of the postdoctoral fellows there, Dr. Horatio, on just exercises in terms of monitoring his attention and increasing his attention and stamina, discussing a lot of this is really awareness and your ability to monitor when you need repetition or when you need to do something in a different way than you were used to before.
And is there a difference between working with an adult's brain who's had a stroke and a child's brain? I mean, does the fact that a child's brain is still developing change the equation? Does it make it easier for them to recover?
You know, there certainly is a discussion in our field about what's called plasticity, and there certainly is plasticity in a child's brain in that there are areas that can compensate different than they can in an adult brain who has a similar neurological injury. But at the same time, it's a little tricky and it's not as great as it sounds because during the process of recovery, it's also the process of new learning and you're taking in a lot more information. And what he was doing at the end of second grade really exponentially increases now that he's in fourth grade. So at the same time that you're recovering and making compensating for things that were difficult, you have to be catching up and getting ahead and doing a lot more. So it definitely is a more dynamic process, both in terms of how a child is healing and doing well, but also in terms of the things that you need to watch out for.
Jonathan, of course, Jared has a twin sister, and so you can see the age. I mean, girls and boys are different, and they are different people, but you can see the development stages very clearly because you have a child of an identical age. Do you see differences? Are you conscious of differences that you think might not be there otherwise?
I would say it's mostly a little bit of the academic and some of the recall and multi-step issues for our son, A, B, C, and D. Perhaps his sister can follow all four directions. Maybe Jared will get lost on occasion after the third. So that kind of deficit we're still working on a little bit, but it was in the first few months, the physical differences were most shocking and most disturbing. As a father who loved going out and playing catch and playing ball with my son, that here was a child who couldn't even throw a baseball, couldn't pick up a ping pong ball, couldn't put two Legos together. The physical disabilities were haunting to witness, and also, you know, but what a phenomenal job the folks at New York Cornell did in working with him, both the physical and, yes, Jared, there were occupational therapists there as well, who were so patient and who worked with him day in and day out for weeks at a time to bring our son back and to front load those sessions to get that rehab going early on, because as the Cornell doctors and therapists explained to us, the faster you get that rehabilitation going, the better the outcomes are in a child. And that's what is so haunting by some of the emails and calls that I got, both in terms of the delayed diagnosis, 24 to 48 hours. You know, it was relatively quick for Jared at Cornell. Yes, you would like to see it in the first minutes as a concerned parent, but Cornell did it relatively quickly in the scheme of diagnosis for pediatric stroke. And then I got emails and calls from people who said it would be weeks before their 19-year-old daughter who, you know, was a ballerina and twisted her neck, or a son who was playing lacrosse and was knocked out and went home, and it took them 2 weeks before they did an MRI and realized what had happened. And time is brain, as Dr. Eichhorn was saying. So what happens to those children in cases where stroke is missed?
Let's go back to the phones to Jim in Vienna, Virginia. Jim, you've joined the Diane Rehm Show. Jim, sure. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
You've joined the program. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi, this is Jim in Vienna. Our son, Eric, had a stroke when he was two in 1999. Luckily, we were very lucky to have Dr. Eichhorn treat him while she was at Johns Hopkins. We did, like your guest on the air, we did not get a definitive diagnosis, but we think that it was linked to strep. He had He had strep twice and then had a subsequent stroke right after each episode of strep. Anyhow, now he's doing great. He's just about to turn 13. He's almost gotten full recovery, a little bit of stiffness. Sometimes we've noticed some wild mood swings after he has strep, but so we always hold onto our seats when he's having strep. But our question now is, what follow-up activities or testing or things that we should be doing now that he's becoming a teenager? And should we reconsider putting him back on aspirin?
Well, Jim, I'm glad to hear that your son is doing well, Dr. Eichhorn.
Well, it's fantastic to hear a voice from the past and to hear that he's doing well. I do remember you very well. And I think the point that Jonathan mentioned earlier in the show about the change over time in recurrence risk, and we are learning more and more about this as we're able to do more research, that as you get to be a year to 2 years out from having that first stroke, if you haven't identified a serious underlying disease like heart disease, then your risk of recurrence is very low. And as best we can tell, that doesn't necessarily change when you go from being a child to a teenager. So I don't think that the imminent approach of adolescence necessarily should change what you're doing. I think that taking another look at old risk factors is probably not going to help you that much at this stage. If he's been doing well all these years, then the expectation would be that he'd continue to do well going into the future.
I'm glad to hear it. Vicky, your other two children are here in the studio. Jared talked a little bit about them and the fact that there's probably a little bit less fighting in your house than there is in my house. What other impact have you seen on the rest of your family, on the other kids?
Well, at the beginning, it was really hard on the other two because our focus as parents for several months was just on Jared and taking him to Philadelphia, taking him to Boston, doing doctor visits was really what we spent most of the first year after his stroke doing. So the other two were sort of slighted a little bit in the sense that, you know, they weren't able to go to Disney World. They weren't able to do some fun things on the weekends that we had typically been doing because we did have to lay low for that year, especially to make sure Jared stayed safe.
And is there a continuing sense, do you think, of insecurity about the future that permeates the family, or do you now feel fairly confident about the prognosis?
I think if you asked me that and asked my husband, you'll get two different answers. But as a mom, yes, I worry all the time. I send him off to school. I tell him every morning to be careful. And I do worry about, you know, the wrestling with the boys and, you know, obviously he can't do a trampoline and things like that. And when he goes to other people's houses, you know, I do have to explain to the parents that, you know, please don't, you know, let them wrestle and, you know, that sort of thing, and just make it known that this did happen to him. And even though you can't see it, it is there. And he still is, I think, at a low risk, but still we don't know what category of risk he's in. And that's always sort of daunting as a parent.
Jared, you get the very last word on the program. There are going to be kids out there who have just had strokes, mm-hmm. who now can't do all the things that you couldn't do for a long time and can't do. Is there anything that you can say to them to make them feel better and a little bit more patient?
Well, you should never give up. Just keep trying to get something better. If you have trouble in your left hand, just like use it a lot to get better.
Jared Dienst. It's so good to see you in the studio and looking so well. And thank you for those words of encouragement to other children as well. You can find a link to Jonathan Dienst's story about Jared and photos of the whole family on our website at drshow.org. I've been joined in the studio by Jonathan Dienst, Victoria Dienst, Dr. Rebecca Eichord has been here too. Dr. David Salzberg has been on the line from New York. Jared's been here as well. Thank you all so much for joining me and sharing your stories and your medical expertise as well.
Thank you so much.
I'm Katty Kay of the BBC sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thank you all so much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.